This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear from Race Matters Slow co-founder Courtney Hale.
At our initial rally, I did make a deliberate choice to feature young speakers, and I think that began to set the tone.
Also, we'll learn about the healthcare challenges facing low-income residents in San Luis Obispo County.
We help people get a provider if they haven't ever been to a primary care provider. We don't want people to go to the ER as their primary care.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, June 15th, 2020. I'm Carol Tangeman. 2 weeks ago, a peaceful protest in San Luis Obispo turned chaotic when police used tear gas, pepper spray, and mace on demonstrators. The following day, San Luis Obispo Police Department Chief Deanna Cantrell and other city officials held a press conference about that controversial decision. Cal Poly grad student and photojournalist Diego Rivera fact-checked some of the statements made by Cantrell on June 2nd. Rivera's story was published in the Mustang News website. KCBX's Greta Mart spoke with Rivera about his reporting.
My name is Diego Rivera, and I go to Cal Poly right now, and I'm getting my master's in environmental science and management. I'm graduating this quarter, and then next year I'm attending the University of Hawaii for my law degree. I've been a photojournalist with Mustang News the past 2 years.
How did this article come about? Whose idea was it? And walk me through it.
So it was actually my idea because I was obviously there, and I was there with my fellow journalist Aiden McGloin too. And I basically was just kind of taking it all in and trying to understand both sides of it, and noticed apart from the march going onto the freeway, it was a generally peaceful protest, and it was very straightforward. There didn't really seem to be anything negative associated with it. And so when the group approached the skirmish line, they were all pretty much ready to go to, like, they were all wearing riot gear. A lot of them already had gas masks on before people even approached. The police did. And so I noticed that it seemed a little bit excessive. And so I kind of, like, I stayed in the front right next to the police line and the line of protesters. And a lot of the protesters were just conversing with police and having, like, peaceful conversations and that kind of thing. And then time went on, and just out of nowhere, it got really busy. Like, the police started moving groups of people and started shoring up their defense. Like, they got really close together, shoulder to shoulder, and a lot of them entered the line. And so once all that happened, the next day, one of my friends was at the press conference. And so I tuned in and watched, and the entire time I was hearing Deanna Cantrell speak, and a lot of the stuff just didn't add up. It wasn't consistent with what I experienced. And it almost seemed like the way that she was describing the events, like she was trying to put the onus on the protesters themselves and take it off of the police. So I basically talked to my editor-in-chief, and he was very excited about doing a fact check. And so I basically took a transcript and read through it again.
So when you say transcript, you mean a transcript of the press conference that was held the following day? Okay.
And found the points that really stuck out that seemed not true. And I also decided to pick certain points because I had photos and videos of the entire thing. And so I wanted to be very thorough backing up my rebuttals. And so I wanted to make sure I at least had a photo or a video along with some quotes from people who were there to back it up. But it was basically this narrative that, oh yeah, the protesters were really unruly. They ran at us at one point. They weren't paying attention to us. They weren't listening. And all of that just was not true.
I too watched that. And Cantrell also heavily relied on the fact about the protesters had gone on the highway. They did, and that's true, that the protesters did go on the highway at one point.
Yes.
And then the justification for deploying the tear gas was that they were threatening to go on the highway again. Did you witness any protesters making a move to go on the highway again?
No, and my fellow reporter Aiden also noticed that there was a lack of discussion of going onto the freeway. And I mean, I was in and out of the crowd. I was at all parts of it. And there was really no talk of going back on the freeway. It seemed like the consensus was they just wanted to keep marching on Santa Rosa. And at one point, some of the leaders of the march had gotten up onto their bullhorn and were encouraging people, hey, the police aren't going to back down, and it's really not important for us to break this line, so please go home. And so at that point, there wasn't really any desire to cross the line. It was more just trying to outlast the police at that point. And so, yeah, as far as I know, I didn't hear really any further discussion of going back onto the freeway.
Okay, let's back up. Were you there as a participant, or were you there as a journalist?
I was there as a journalist.
Okay, got it. And so let's talk about your piece itself. Tell me what you found. Let's go through point by point.
Okay. So the first one, the point that really stuck out was when Cantrell said, as far as the gas goes, we waited a long time. We negotiated a whole lot. And to me, that stuck out because there was not a sustained negotiation between the sides. It was hours into it, the first time that an address was made by the police directly to the crowd was when they got off the freeway, and I think that was 2 or 3 hours into the march itself. And then there was no further discussion until the group reached the skirmish line at Santa Rosa and Walnut. And even then, I feel like the word negotiated, it really misrepresents what happened, because it was more the police broadcasting these orders and not having any dialogue with the protesters. And so the only time that any sort of negotiation happened was when the police pulled in one of the leaders past the skirmish line and spoke for a few minutes. And then when they reached an impasse, that was it. They sent them back out. And then, like I would say, probably 30 or 40 more minutes went by, and then the violence broke out. So negotiation, like a sustained negotiation, it didn't really happen that way.
Let's go to the next one.
The next point is, they basically said, oh, we set up a very hard skirmish line at Marsh. An announcement was given, a dispersal order was given at that point of an unlawful protest. And so the problem with that was these announcements were not loud enough for even the people in the front to hear, because I was up at the front next to the police and the front line of the protesters, and I couldn't hear what was being announced. And so you have hundreds of people trying to speak and chant all at the same time. And in addition to that bass noise, they also had a propeller plane circling overhead and a CHP chopper. So all that noise mixed together, just it was too loud for any announcement to be heard over just one bullhorn. They may have been attempting to tell the group what to do and trying to get them to disperse, but all of that mixed in together kind of displays to me that they didn't do their best to make sure the whole crowd heard what was being said.
I see. Okay. And so when we say skirmish line, describe that.
So basically, it was about, I want to say, 25 police officers stretched in the crosswalk across Santa Rosa. And so maybe about a foot or two space between them. But basically, all these 25 officers had bulletproof vests on, riot helmets, they had shields at the ready, they had their batons in their hand. So basically, they're geared up to the teeth, ready to skirmish, more or less, with the protesters.
Okay, and what's next?
The next one that I want to highlight is Cantrell said, we had called for the helicopter to move out, and it did, and called for the plane to move out, and it did. We certainly tried everything that we could to make sure everybody heard that announcement. The plane, and not just this day, but every single protest I've been to in the past week, the plane is circling overhead the entire time the protest is taking place, and even hours afterwards and before, just to keep an eye on where they're moving and where they're going. And so to rebut that, I had a video, and honestly, there were multiple videos where you could clearly hear the plane or the helicopter in the background above the noise. And then also I made sure to take some pictures of them flying overhead too. And so it was about 6 p.m. when the protesters got to the line of police, And so I have a picture of the CHP helicopter flying at that time. And then about 25 minutes before the violence broke out, there's another picture of the helicopter flying again. And so for those 2 hours that they were face to face with each other, there was an aircraft circling the whole time.
That was Cal Poly grad student and photojournalist Diego Rivera speaking to KCBX's Greta Mart about Rivera's reporting on the June 1st protest in San Luis Obispo and his fact-checking of how the San Luis Obispo Police Department explained its decisions. Go to the KCBX website to hear the full interview and find a link to Rivera's Mustang News story. Working Lunch is a weekly Facebook Live conversation between the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce and someone in the community doing interesting or innovative work. Today, we'll hear from Race Matters Slow co-founder Courtney Hale.
Hello, welcome to Working Lunch, the Slow Chamber's weekly series where we get to sit down with community leaders. And I'm Jim D'Antona, President and CEO of the Slow Chamber. And today, you'll get a peek behind the work going on with Slow Chamber board member and co-founder of Race Matters Slow County, Courtney Hale. In 2016, she co-founded Race Matters, formed in response to the killing of unarmed Black men by law enforcement. A group of like-minded people began to meet, seeing a need for local engagement around racial and social justice. The grassroots organization now presents anti-racism workshops, special events, and cultural projects. Recently, the organization has come into heightened focus following the death of George Floyd and the ensuing protests. Thank you so much for being here, Courtney.
Thank you so much for having me.
If someone was just waking up from a coma or crawling out from under a rock or an alien visiting from another planet, what's the most important thing that you'd want them to know about this movement right now?
The most important thing I'd want people to know about our local movement is that it is organically unfolding. It is a coalition movement. There are many groups and perspectives and strategies involved. And so Race Matters isn't necessarily connected to every protest. It's a youth-led movement. It's a movement where we're seeing more local Black voices emerge, and we are not a monolith. And so following Black voices and amplifying Black voices has rightfully so been anchored in the larger movement and in our local movement in terms of following Black leadership. That said, there is a diversity of Black voices here, and that there's different ways to show up to the movement, and that people, as we're all trying to be our best selves and do better as a world and as a local community, knowing that there are many strategies, many groups, and a diversity of Black voices here.
Race Matters obviously has long been an organizing force, pushing for inclusion, equity, and justice through our arts and cultural work. And recently there have been some amazing students and younger people, as you were just mentioning, who are getting more attention as leaders of protests and political action. What's it been like to work with them?
It's been awesome. At our initial rally on Sunday that was planned in a day, I did make a deliberate choice to feature young speakers, and I think that began to set the tone for who is leading the marches, and it's really their movement. Certainly, we have a relationship with some of the young activists, but we certainly don't control, nor should we, the young Black voices who are emerging, but it's been great. It's their movement for sure. I will say that. Someone wrote in and said, these protests aren't convenient because I get off work at this time. Could you do something about that? I was like, I don't manage all of them, but it is youth led and they're passionate and they're going out there sort of on their own schedules too.
You know, you see the energy coming from these young folks, and as folks are trying to say, like, is there like one group organizing? Clearly, even in our small county, there have been so many rallies and marches organized by a variety of groups and individuals. That, to me, seems like one of the hardest parts. What is it like to balance supporting that grassroots action while also striving for organization, consensus, and clarity in that?
So supporting the grassroots movement and also the organization and clarity, that phrase pretty much sums up how difficult this work is and how intense the last 10 or so days have been, because there is that the passion and the anger that should not be censored or try to be controlled. But at the same time, with Race Matters, whether we like it or not, no matter how many statements we put out, we are, I think, connected to the protest arm, associated with the protest arm of the movement. And so there is a responsibility to begin to guide and talk about, well, what do we want to see locally and what requests are we making and how do we sustain the movement? And yes, the movement takes meetings and a lot of Zooming and behind the scenes work, research. It's incredibly labor intensive beyond marching. And so we've just had to rise to the moment. We didn't really have a choice. And so we're learning. I think our whole city is learning really quickly, and our area hasn't seen, anyone can correct me if I'm wrong, but a protest movement like this here, and it's moving so fast. And so just listening and learning is what we advise and what we're also needing to do in this moment.
I wonder if you'd be able to kind of describe, you talked about, you know, the Black Lives Matter organization. And is that a formal organization? Are those things that, are you connected? Is Race Matter Slow connected? Maybe just a little bit of how that kind of
We're our own organization. We were founded in solidarity with Black Lives Matter and created our own group that at the time we felt was a good fit for our community. And so while we are very much in this racial justice moment and with protests and moving forward to policy, we also, as you mentioned before, have an arts and culture focus and a social focus. And so we're in a lot of different lanes that don't necessarily make us a fit to be a Black Lives Matter chapter. And we also have no one's sort of like in charge of us in terms of, oh, we have to check with National for this or that. And so that allows us to make a documentary film when we want to, or now we're very involved in the protests and policy and allows us to be flexible.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. You're listening to a conversation between Courtney Hale, co-founder of Race Matters Slow, and Jim D'Antona of the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce.
Back to, we must have been like August when we first met and we talked about you joining the Slow Board Chamber. And you talked about obviously the value of allies, but also how important it is to have places where Black people see themselves and are not necessarily spending so much time educating well-meaning white people on how to be a good ally. And then back in February, you launched the Belonging Event Series that was designed to kind of tell the stories of everyday community members sharing their own experiences of living in a predominantly white rural area. Can you share a little bit more about your inspiration for the Belonging Series and any hopes for its growth in the future as you were talking about that art?
And so I was originally inspired. I think I saw that funds were available from the city for promotion and it started sparking ideas. And I was drawn more to an arts and culture base to amplify Black voices. And it was really based in our mission to center the lived experiences of Black and other people of color. And so we might have an event where there is an expert and you need that. We have many educational resources, again, to educate the larger community. But what it comes down to is lived experience. What is it like living here? You don't have to be an expert to talk about that because we're all experts in our own experience, right? And so I just wanted to show that through through interviews and quotes with local Black folks, with beautiful photography by Renata Campbell Photography. And we had a wonderful partner in the Downtown Slow Association to display those photographs. And also the documentary film about Cut to Be the Best, which was a multicultural space, barbershop, but definitely a Black space in terms of where people could feel like they belonged without being confined with any tokenization that can take place in predominantly white communities, expectations. And so that was really the motivation behind that project. And I do acknowledge with that project, the voices I shared aren't the only Black voices ever. It was, you know, you do look to your social circle and beyond and okay, who's available. And I want to acknowledge that there's other Black voices emerging, NAACP, Black members of the Diversity Coalition of SLO County, and also just the protest leaders who have emerged. And so acknowledging that that race matters with that project, it's not like, these are the Black people, the only ones. And so with that, since we're seeing the new voices emerge, definitely when we look to belonging or a like project, I'm excited that we'll have more people to pull from. And so that outreach will be definitely a priority. Our website does have a Black-owned business directory. Interestingly, that's another initiative that we launched in our Black Business Belongs event during the Belonging event series. And it's interesting how that people are tripping over themselves now to support Black businesses, Black-owned businesses, and to find out where they are. And so, and that's a wonderful, that's of course, wonderful, but it's so, having been working on these initiatives prior to this moment, it's satisfying, but and to see this change. And I just hope it continues and that it's unfortunate that it took a video so cruel, so traumatic, for all this change that we've seen across the country with businesses, NASCAR, the NFL, there's a Black Bachelor. I mean, we never thought we'd see that. It's great, but I just hope this continues and that it's not only a reaction and that it's a sustained effort to do better and really think critically about how to do better. And it's hard. It's not just putting a Black Lives Matter sign up. It's really critically engaging how you might have been benefited from the system of institutionalized racism and how aspects of that might live within you and really challenging that.
I think that's a rarely important part. And from the ally perspective, you know, one of the things that I'm interested in getting your feedback is there's a lot of question about what can white allies do to support? Is it preferred that we bring ideas to this table and then see is this helpful, or rather than saying, hey, what can we do?
Definitely talking amongst each other, challenge your own community. There's a ton of resources online. There's even 75 things white people can do for racial justice. That was pinned to the top of our Facebook for a while. So there's no shortage of resources out there. And definitely seeking those resources before asking Black people in your life, what can I do? Because that is, in a sense, demanding labor in terms of us then, you know, giving you the list and some people might not mind it, but in general, especially at this time, which is a traumatic and grieving time for everyone, but particularly Black Americans who've had this trauma going back generations, it's important to seek resources on your own and challenge your own communities, inner circles, families, and yourselves.
What was it like to grow up here a while back? And when you came back, what kind of made you want to stay?
In terms of what made me stay, it's a really good question, because there is, there's no diversity here. There's nothing to do. and part of what I guess I feel needed here, and I feel that I rise to the moment more than, if I'm being totally honest, if I lived in a larger city and there were all of these arts programs and rallies and amplification of Black voices already happening, I don't know that I would get super involved, or maybe I'd find something else to do, but I see the need here, and I also see opportunity here, because it's a smaller community. You can make things happen pretty quickly and key into the people who can help you in order to change the reality. And so that's what, with race matters, without it being a defined goal, it's like, okay, rather than talking about what we don't have, let's start to shift our own reality and create spaces of belonging and try to change the narrative. And it's definitely not easy. It's hard work, whether it's an arts program or the moment we're in right now. But I'd say I feel needed and rise to the leadership moment here and feel motivated to change the reality here instead of just talking about what we don't have.
And Courtney, thank you so much.
That was Courtney Hale, co-founder of Race Matters Slow, speaking with Jim D'Antona of the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce. Michelle Shoresman of the San Luis Obispo County Public Health Department talks with KCBX correspondent Tom Wilmer about her job helping find medical coverage for those residents who cannot afford it.
I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from the San Luis Obispo County Health Department. And we're here with Michelle Shoresman. And your exact title, your area of responsibility is what?
The Division Manager for Healthcare Access.
Okay. And what does that encompass?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a vague title, I guess. But basically, staff within my division help people get access to healthcare, whatever that means. So we have a couple of small programs.
People that are financially troubled or limited resources.
Yes. One of our programs is called the Medically Indigent Services Program, which is a very vague title. What it does is it covers healthcare expenses for people that find themselves in a medically vulnerable situation in an ER or a victim of a medical emergency that don't have insurance. And if they meet certain income requirements and they don't have insurance, then the county covers their medical costs. People go to an emergency room. They aren't established with a primary care provider. They don't know how to access services, and the only place they know to get help is an ER. Mm-hmm. So maybe some people go to an ER sometimes that aren't necessarily appropriate for an ER, because we try to save emergency rooms for those that are really emergent situations.
So it sounds like a really important mission for y'all is to educate on where to seek out primary.
We help people get a provider if they haven't mm-hmm. ever been to a primary care provider. We don't want people to go to the ER as their primary care.
So where does somebody go for healthcare help?
Most people qualify for Medi-Cal. Mm-hmm. And if a person is appropriate for Medi-Cal and they meet those requirements, then we'll help them do a Medi-Cal application. If they don't qualify for Medi-Cal and they have an emergent medical need, they've been to the ER or something like that, then if they qualify for our program, we will enroll them in our program.
Your program, explain a little bit about that.
That's the Medically Indigent Services Program. Mm-hmm. So we cover people who meet certain income requirements if they have an emergent medical need. Other folks that don't have an emergent medical need and don't have insurance, we help them apply for Covered California and find a plan that they can afford so that they can then get enrolled with a primary care provider and avoid those expensive emergency room visits.
And how do you do your outreach, or do they have to reach out to you?
It happens a lot of ways. It happens both ways. We do outreach with other providers. We do outreach with the hospitals. We instruct hospitals on our program. We'd instruct Department of Social Services on our programs. We do some outreach with places like Cal Poly, so that if they have indigent students who aren't covered on their parents' insurance plans, that they can come to us and help get coverage. We do some outreach at the homeless shelter. Basically, we go places that we think that people might be uninsured, and we try to help them where they are.
Very cool. And do you have posters that you put out?
Yeah, we have brochures, and so we give those to various service providers. Mm-hmm. We also get a fair number of people that just walk into our office here on Johnson, because we are co-located with Drug and Alcohol Services and the County Mental Health. And so people will just be directed by their providers that are working with them in drug and alcohol or mental health, or they'll just wander in here looking for services. One thing that's important and noteworthy right now is that generally you can't apply for insurance on Covered California year-round.
Oh, there's only windows of open enrollment?
Sure.
Based on birth date or?
No, based on a certain time of year. It's similar to what an employer does, where mm-hmm. usually an employer will have 1 month out of the year where they'll allow you to make changes or add people to your plan. Mm-hmm. But ever since COVID-19 started, Covered California has released their requirement that you have to apply during a certain period of time. It's usually between about November and January that you have to apply.
Mm-hmm. But right now it's open-ended.
But right now you only have to say that you didn't have insurance because of COVID-19 and you can apply for insurance mm-hmm. now. We just had a client in here earlier today that was doing an application with our enrollment counselor. So, and got signed up for a plan. So now they didn't have insurance a few weeks ago, but now as soon as they pay their premium, they'll be able to get insured and go find a healthcare provider.
And what might be the cost of a Covered California insurance policy? How much?
They range in prices. It's kind of similar to what you would find on the private market where mm-hmm. you have the gold plan or the bronze plan or the cheaper plans.
Mm-hmm. What would be the minimum to get some coverage?
You can find a plan for as cheap as a dollar a month.
Wow.
That is assuming that you fit the income requirements. Mm-hmm. There are different levels of subsidies that people can get based on their income. So, mm-hmm.
So what sort of income would you have to have? Basically nothing?
In order to get those minimum plans, you would have to have something just above what qualifies you for Medi-Cal.
Which is roughly?
Someone qualifies for Covered California premium assistance, which is those cheap plans for adults. If they are a single individual and they make $49,960. So the income levels are reasonable, especially given the cost of living in the state of California. Someone who it's very reasonable to find somebody who only makes $50,000.
I know a lot of people that qualify based on that.
Yeah. So and then it goes up from there with the number of people in your household.
So what you're saying, bottom line, is that healthcare is accessible to everybody in the county at a very affordable rate.
Yeah, really with the premium assistance in Covered California since the Affordable Care Act was passed, there's really no reason for anybody to be uninsured in California, especially if they are low income, because they can qualify for Medi-Cal. And if they don't qualify for Medi-Cal, they can qualify for a very inexpensive plan on Covered California.
So a little bit more about your world and your day-to-day, your firefighting, you know, the things that you focus on.
We do a lot in my division with coordination of care. We try to teach people how to advocate for themselves, how to look for a provider, how to go on a website and find the provider lists for a particular insurance plan that they have, how to talk about things like premiums and co-pays, what deductibles mean. There's a lot of terminology in the healthcare world that makes it scary for people mm-hmm. and hard to understand. And so I think there's a certain amount of language that you need to acquire in order to talk to a provider intelligently and get your questions answered and not be afraid of what the answers might be.
What do you spend your day doing? You do a lot of interaction with people?
Yeah, I have a nurse navigator that usually does a lot of that one-on-one communication with clients. Yeah. We also have a woman named Susanna that's out here in our front office today, and she does Covered California applications and Medi-Cal applications with people. She's very knowledgeable about insurance programs and benefit programs in the county. So if we can't help them, then she generally knows where to send them. At my level, I end up doing a lot of coordination with providers, different service organizations in the county, like CAPSLO or...
What is CAPSLO?
CAPSLO is an organization that runs the 40 Prado homeless shelter. Mm-hmm. That organization, the other homeless services organizations in the county, like ECHO up in North County, El Camino Homeless Organization, which also runs a small shelter in Atascadero. Mm-hmm. I think that in a county like ours where people are geographically isolated from large urban centers where there are a lot of specialty care providers, a lot of primary care providers, a lot of big hospitals, a lot of places where they can go to get care, it becomes more challenging to get care, and it becomes more important for the various organizations that operate within a county like this to coordinate with each other and set up local systems and safety nets that people can fall into. And so we try to help fill one of those gaps in helping people get the insurance they need, and then fill the second gap of getting them connected to the right type of care at the right provider.
So bottom line is, in San Luis Obispo County, health care is accessible to everybody.
It is. You just have to know how to look for it, where to look for it, and how to advocate for yourself.
Michelle Shoresman, thanks for sharing.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. To learn more about your world, you have a go-to website.
Yes, slowpublichealth.org/MISP.
Thanks again, Michelle.
Thank you.
All right, I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from San Luis Obispo.
While government insurance covers the poorest of the poor, there are still Americans who fall into a gap. They make too much to qualify for Medicaid, but can't afford to buy insurance on the marketplace. The newer clinics in San Luis Obispo County aims to close that gap. Here's Direct Relief News' Amerika Raffanelli with more.
Since he was a kid, Ahmad Nuristani knew he wanted to be a doctor.
I'm from Afghanistan. There's no healthcare system. It is something that is non-existent and it's rare, right?
Becoming a physician seemed like the best way to help. He started by setting up clinics throughout his home country and eventually went to Africa to do the same. After graduating from medical school in 2008, Nuristani moved to San Luis Obispo, California, to work as a hospitalist. Within his first year, he recognized a trend. The patients coming into the emergency department hadn't been to a doctor in years.
All of a sudden, they come to the hospital because they have a heart attack, they have a stroke, or their sugars are crazy high, and everyone had one thing in common. They don't have insurance.
At the time, 20% of San Luis Obispo residents were uninsured. While the coastal community has a higher median income than many places in the United States, quality health care was out of reach for a significant portion of the population.
I was in Africa. They don't have anything. You know, I mean, people travel 10 days to get to a clinic, right? And because they just don't have access. Now here, you have physicians, you have doctors, you have hospitals, you have clinics. But guess what? You can't use it because you don't have money. So there's no difference.
To fill the gap, Nuristani took on a side project. After 3 years of paperwork and countless fundraising events, the Nor Clinic Foundation was born. The clinic provides free medical services to people who don't have insurance. When the clinic opened in 2011, Nuristani was the only doctor on staff. He would come in to see patients on his day off.
First year I saw, I don't know, maybe about 500 plus patients. This year we're up to almost 7,000.
The Nor Clinic Foundation is one of 1,400 free clinics across the United States, providing free medical care to over 2 million uninsured Americans.
Free and charitable clinics really are the net below America's safety net.
That's Nicole Lamoureux, the CEO of the National Association of Free and Charitable Clinics.
Free and charitable clinics serve the medically underserved.
These are usually people that make too much to qualify for government insurance, but can't afford to buy insurance on the marketplace. While 35 million Americans gained insurance under the Affordable Care Act, there's still 27 million people in the United States who don't have insurance.
One of the biggest misconceptions since the passage of the Affordable Care Act is that everyone in America has insurance now, or everyone in America has access to Medicaid now, and nothing could be farther from the truth.
In order to qualify for Medicaid, individuals must make 100% or less of the federal poverty level, which is set at $12,500 a year. In states that expanded Medicaid, the threshold was increased to 138%. But even in a Medicaid expansion state like California, individuals making more than $18,000 a year don't qualify. Nuristani says many of the patients that come into the clinic aren't necessarily poor.
And a lot of people are middle class that really need the help because they make enough, but they don't make enough. They can't afford to get insurance, right? You know, they drive a nice car, they have a house, they even have a small business, but guess what? It is extremely expensive.
So how do clinics like NOR provide medical services for free?
Can you just give me your name?
Dr. Nancy O'Malley, O'Malley.
Great.
And I'm the medical director here at the NOR Clinic.
Great. And you're a volunteer?
Volunteer.
Dr. O'Malley is one of 400 volunteers that works at the NOR Clinic Foundation. She comes in every Wednesday morning to see patients.
Why did you decide to become a volunteer for NOR?
Well, I had some free time. You know, my kids are all gone now, and I had a little extra free time. And I'd heard from people in town about the clinic. And so I stopped by to just have a tour of it and look around. And I thought, well, gosh, they have a need, and I have some free time. I'll volunteer. And I was surprised at how much I enjoyed it. So once I started volunteering, I really, really enjoyed it.
There are over 200,000 volunteers like O'Malley staffing free clinics across the country. They make it possible to provide high-quality health care at no cost to the patient. While labor is a significant expense of running a clinic, it's not the only one. Equipment, medication, rent, all of these things come at a price, and it's up to the clinic to cover them. Unlike federally qualified health centers, which provide care to patients on a sliding scale, free clinics receive minimal, if any, federal funding. They rely almost entirely on private donations and grant dollars. While NOR Stani works hard to raise money, he says the clinic wouldn't be where it is today without unsolicited acts of generosity.
Every time we have come across any kind of obstacle and we're in need, somebody has stepped in, an angel has appeared.
Before he could open the clinic, NOR Stani had to meet a host of building code requirements, which turned out to be an expensive endeavor. The building needed to be outfitted with a heating, ventilation, and air conditioning system in order to get up to code. It would cost $20,000.
We somehow put it on the newspaper saying, look, you know, we need some help for donation. So I'm in the hospital working, taking care of a patient that came in completely confused, had no idea where he was. He had some liver problem. And I took care of him. An hour later, he sat up from his chair. This guy is extremely confused. He doesn't know who his wife or kid, anybody else is. He looks at me, he goes, are you Dr. NOR Stani? I said, yes. He goes, I heard you need the money and I will write the check for you. And then out, cold. His family's looking at me. We're looking at each other. What had just happened?
4 days later, NOR Stani received a check in the mail for $20,000. He says these kinds of extraordinary acts happen more often than one would think. Some of the clinic's most expensive pieces of equipment have been bought using donor dollars. Their EKG machine, all of their lab equipment, their electronic medical record program. Without donor support, NOR Stani would have had to buy these items himself, making the prospect of starting a free clinic a financial impossibility. While providing free healthcare isn't free, the price of not providing it is greater. For people who don't have insurance, the emergency department is often the first place they go should they need care. More than half of the time, these visits could have been prevented at the primary care level for much less than the cost of an ER visit.
The impact that we're having is what we're doing is making sure that people are using emergency rooms for emergencies. And they're not using emergency rooms for the common cold or cough or chronic disease management.
60% of ER visits are related to a chronic condition like diabetes or high blood pressure. For these patients, a steady supply of medication like insulin could prevent a potentially life-threatening event. By offering patients preventative care services, free clinics are reducing the number of unnecessary ER visits and saving individuals thousands in healthcare costs.
The average ER cost is $1,389. So that's just if you go to the ER and it's an average cost. Could be a little bit more, could be a little less, depending on what you need. But if you use the cited average, $1,389, and you times that by 2 million people, that everyone just needed to go to the ER once, during a year. That's $2,778,000,000 that will impact uncompensated care in ERs across the country.
Uncompensated care are healthcare services that hospitals aren't reimbursed for, usually because a person doesn't have insurance and can't afford to pay in full. In 2018, hospitals provided $41 billion worth of uncompensated care to patients that couldn't pay. While hospitals absorb most of these costs, the American public pays too. Federal and local governments give hospitals money to offset the costs, and insurance companies charge customers higher premiums.
We know that prior to the ACA, each one of us was paying an additional $1,000 on all of our health insurance premiums to cover uncompensated care across the United States of America. And that was in 2010. So even if you just look at those numbers based on inflation, it would be dramatic to the cost of the care that we would need, because there would be no place for someone to go. They would be utilizing it in the ER. The ER would be reporting it to insurance rates. Insurance rates would go up, and more money would be needed to be impacted on taxpayers.
But economic factors are not the only expenses to consider. According to a study published in 2009, the uninsured have a 40% higher risk of dying than those with insurance. Researchers at the Harvard Medical School estimate that a lack of insurance is linked to the death of more than 40,000 Americans a year. So, at the very least, free clinics are helping 2 million Americans live healthier, longer lives.
We're saving life here, and who's going to say no to that?
For Direct Relief, this is Amarie Garafinelli.
If you've been watching funny videos and sitcoms while staying home, you may be glad to hear it's good for your health. UC Santa Barbara Professor of Communication Robin Nabby published research looking at the positive effects of entertainment media as it relates to stress, illness, and goal attainment.
This is Beth Thornton. I'm talking with Professor Robin Nabby, Department of Communication at UC Santa Barbara. She recently published a paper in the Journal of Communication called Media Prescriptions, exploring the therapeutic effects of entertainment media on stress relief, illness symptoms, and goal attainment.
Thank you for joining me.
Oh, thank you for having me, Beth.
Your research is very interesting in that you explore how media can be beneficial to our well-being, which is not usually what we hear in reports about media. So tell us why you chose this topic.
I've always been interested in the intersection between media, emotion, and health. And in the literature, overwhelmingly, we see an emphasis on the negative effects of media. So whether it's violent depictions, whether it's too much television binge watching and being sedentary, so the messages through the media or the time we spend consuming media and the negative effects it has. And ultimately, media is a tool, which means it can be used in ways that can be detrimental to our health, but can also enhance. And there's so little research on that. So I decided to put my energies in that direction.
And were you already focused on this pre-pandemic? Or is this something that came about with everything that's going on?
This was pre-pandemic. I've been interested in how people cope using media for about a decade. And so this study just happened to be published when the pandemic was just beginning, but we've been interested in these issues for a while.
And you're at a university, so were you studying primarily college students?
This study is on college students. In light of COVID-19, we've actually run a couple of studies in the past 2 months that look at how people are coping with the stress associated with COVID. We have a nationally representative sample for those studies.
Just a brief overview of how you tested the participants.
Basically, the idea that was generating the study was that it seems as though when you ask people when they're stressed, what they do, they say, I watch TV. But there's very, very little research looking at that phenomenon. And what little research is there says, well, it doesn't really have long-term effects. So we were interested in what happens if we give people media messages that are uplifting and inspiring, because there's a lot of research that suggests that when people feel positive emotions, that it's beneficial to them in a number of factors, physiologically, psychologically. So our thought was, rather than just say, hey, go watch TV, what if we prescribe, so to speak, certain types of media messages and see what the effect of those different types of messages are over time. So we had three positive emotion conditions. We had YouTube videos, they're about 5 minutes long, that evoked amusement, right? So funny videos. We had calming videos like nature scenes, and we had inspiring videos. So those focused on underdogs overcoming adversity to achieve their goal.
The participants self-identified with anxiety or depression, is that right?
Not necessarily. So we had undergraduates participate in the study, and undergraduates are highly stressed, as it turns out, more so now than ever, but they tend to be a highly stressed population. So on average, they experienced moderate to high levels of stress during the course of our study.
I'm talking with Professor Robin Nabby about her research on media and stress relief.
We recruited the undergraduates, and we gave them a fairly extensive survey asking a number of questions about their mental health and resilience and that sort of thing. We also asked them about any goals that they were hoping to achieve in the coming weeks. And then the following Monday, every day for 5 days, we emailed them a link for a video that suited their conditions. So they were randomly assigned to either the hope condition, the humor condition, the calm nature condition, or one group got nothing, right? They just got these little surveys. And every day after the survey, we asked, how are you feeling? And then a couple days after the study was over, we gave them another long survey asking about their stress, their illness symptoms, how they felt about their progress towards their goals and what actions they'd taken. And then 10 days later, we checked in with them again. But basically what we found was that regardless of what condition they were in, if they were receiving this positively valenced media, and again, just 5 minutes a day, they could watch it at any point during the day that suited them. And we didn't tell them, don't watch the news, or we didn't give them any instruction about how else to use media. We're just adding in this little bit. And what we found was that regardless of the condition, all of those experimental groups reported lower stress, both during the intervention as well as those couple of days after the intervention. And those in the humorous group, in the funny video condition, 10 days later, they were still reporting lower stress. So as we saw the control group that got nothing, their stress was slowly increasing. We saw the experimental groups, their stress decreasing.
Give us an example. I believe in the study you talk about cat videos or...
Yeah, well, you know, those cute little cat videos where they're chasing a ball of string or that sort of thing. there was one, I think one of the clips was of Ellen DeGeneres in one of her, I don't know if it was a stand-up, she was dancing and, you know, a little bit of her humor. The underdog videos were, one of them was a dog that was born with two legs that was able to walk. And another was a scene from the movie Pursuit of Happiness. And I don't want to ruin the movie for anyone, but there's some inspiring moments within that film. So that was one of the, again, just a 5 minute clip. I think the nature ones were, you know, flowers blooming, like one of those time lapse, or these like magnificent vistas of mountains and ocean and that sort of thing.
So you're suggesting that media as an intervention may be useful in boosting people's moods, or the research actually suggests that this might be something to prescribe to people.
Exactly. So we know that when people are in better moods, physiologically, their body functions better, they handle stress better, their relationships go more smoothly. So we know that positive emotions have a lot of benefits for people. So the question then is, where does that positive emotion come from? And oftentimes the suggestions that we get are things like think more positively. And exercise, and that will release endorphins, and then you'll feel better. Or do things that you love, do things that you enjoy, and then you'll have positive mood, and that will benefit you. But what's oftentimes absent from that conversation is to watch a TV show that you like, right? Or videos that make you laugh.
This is Beth Thornton. I'm talking with Professor Robin Nabby about her research on media and stress relief.
Interesting that now during the pandemic, there's been a number of news stories that have said, hey, here are some things you can watch during the pandemic. Here are some feel-good movies that you can watch. So it seems like we naturally gravitate towards these types of options to help boost our mood. And yet we oftentimes don't think of it as a legitimate way to try to help us regulate our mood so that we can manage stress better.
Did you notice any changes in vital signs?
It's a really good question. We just had them watching the videos in their home, so we emailed them links to the video, so we didn't have access to their heart rate or any other physiological measure. But I did do a study that was published several years ago where we measured cortisol, which is called the stress hormone. Right? So when we're under stress, our body releases more cortisol. And we were looking at how when people are watching different types of media, what their levels of cortisol is. And it turns out, not just in our study, but in others, that when people are watching media, their cortisol rates tend to go down. Their cortisol levels tend to go down. And the argument, and by the way, this is not just in response to humor, but scary movies also. Just like, well, that's strange. You know, from an outside perspective, you might think, well, if you're watching something scary, shouldn't your cortisol spike because you're feeling anxious and stressed? But the idea is that if you enjoy watching scary movies or you're watching with someone who you like to be with, that it would make sense that the experience is enjoyable. And if you can relax in that experience, whether the content is suspenseful or dramatic or funny, it's the more global experience that your body is responding to.
Do you see a role for media literacy in helping people with coping skills as well?
Because this line of research is so new, the link to media literacy hasn't been made. Where I tend to take it is more in the direction of emotional intelligence, right? So the question is, less about how do we understand how media is made and why they look the way they do and the kinds of effects it can have, which is typically what media literacy research focuses on, but more how do I regulate myself? What moods are productive for me? What emotions are productive? And how can I regulate that? So the question I've been asking in my research is how is it that those who are higher or lower in this skill to recognize and regulate emotions, how do they use media? And we've been finding a lot of pretty strong relationships between those who are higher in emotional intelligence and their use of multiple forms of media.
And how does one improve their emotional intelligence?
It's a skill set. So the good news is that it's possible to do it. It requires, and there's four different skills associated with emotional intelligence. The first one is recognizing emotions in yourself and others. So just recognizing, well, I'm feeling really stressed right now, which some people are really good at and others aren't. Recognizing that you're feeling anxious or feeling depressed doesn't come as naturally to some people. So being able to develop that self-awareness of, let me take a moment, what is it that I'm feeling? How would I label that? And then ultimately it reaches the final stage, which is regulation. So saying, okay, I see I'm stressed. I understand why I'm stressed. What do I do about it now?
What advice do you have for our listeners?
Psychologists recommend, and around COVID-19 and other major stressors, you know, the recommendation is to do things that help you to relax and unwind. And what I would say is media can be a healthy part of that picture. If watching your favorite show makes you feel good, then that's just as, you know, valuable for you as crocheting is to somebody else.
That was Professor Robin Nabby, Department of Communication at UC Santa Barbara. This is Beth Thornton for Issues and Ideas.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all of our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today, or to listen to past segments. It's at kcbx.org.